with one kill.
Yeah, ultimately, I think whatever is dear to the heart is a good title.
Because why would we do anything?
Why would we do anything that's not dear to the heart?
Sometimes we have to sacrifice and do some things that are not dear to the heart to ultimately get closer to a life that is dear to the heart. For example, we study in a university because, not necessarily because we want to do that, but because we want a degree which gives us a better platform and so on. So sometimes it is sacrifice. But as long as it's connected to what is truly dear to the heart, it has meaning. One thing that is dear to my heart is music. What can I do? As long as I can remember in my life, I have been singing. And a day without singing, I would consider a day of misery. So, therefore, I'll begin with that. We begin with the Maha Mantra. My singing didn't start out like that. I used to sing with my sister during dishwashing, because my sister is also quite good singer, and I met her the other day, and then someone said, "He is a good musician," right? And then she said, "We have a good ear." So that's sort of in the family. Anyhow, whatever it may be, at one point in music, for me, music was never just entertainment. I was always looking for a sacred dimension within music, something more. I saw music as a vehicle to connect me to a more sacred dimension, and both in making music and listening music, I listened to that. So in a way, it's not surprising that I came eventually to the chanting of mantras, which is sacred music, and that is what we'll do for a little while today as a means of meditation. And let's see what tune we'll do today. So the nature of all living beings is to become disconnected of our true nature, disconnected from reality, because we become very swept up in the turmoil of events which arise from nature. Nature, as Bhagavad Gita describes it, has three qualities: goodness, passion, and ignorance. So activities of ignorance are those that make us forgetful, that make us they make us forgetful. Ignorance, sleep, intoxication, illusion, madness, all these things, or horror movies, or so many other movies. Then there is the mode of passion. The mode of passion offers us opportunities. The mode of passion offers us all kinds of interesting possibilities. Oh, We can't let them go by. I would never forgive myself. Never. The mode of goodness is thoughtful, is reflective and meditative, and is looking for the long-term benefit as to what is durable. Passion, oh, the here and now, immediate, grab it while you can. Ignorance, block it out, whatever it is, just block out reality. So, the three modes of material nature exist within our consciousness, and they also exist around us in the environment. So, the first thing that we do with the chanting of the mantra is to shake off the effect of these lower modes of passion and ignorance, and to at least get resituated in goodness, to reconnect. We can feel the soothing sound, and we can feel how the influence of all the things that affect us so much are just drifting away as the mantra is flowing along like a river with endless waves. One time, the American poet from the 60s raised a question to Robert Allen Ginsberg, I forgot to say, raised a question to Srila Prabhupada, and his question was as to how is it possible to capture spirit in matter? He said in many traditions of the world they will not allow the worship of any images because of that basic principle. How can you capture spirit in matter? And the same would apply to sound. I mean, it's music, nice, but how can one capture spirit in matter? Prabhupada's answer to that was that he said, matter doesn't exist because everything is spiritual. So that is the true vision of the mystic. I'm writing a book since a long time, and a slow writer, but anyway, I'm writing it. And the topic of the book, it deals with constructing a space to capture the sacred, somehow or other, to capture it. And the introduction begins somewhere on an airport. Why not? Because you have to start somewhere in a book, right? So it starts on an airport in Frankfurt, and on that airport many people from all over the world, they meet, and each is on his way to his own destination, and in a sense full of expectation of what is to come, because that is an airport. It is a place where one is full of expectations, because you're going into a new situation. Then, on that airport, the restaurant has like a big 2-meter cutout profile of Goethe, the famous German poet, philosopher, because after all, Frankfurt is his birthplace. So Goethe, he wrote in his Maxims and Reflections some short sentences, phrases, paragraphs with different insights in life. And at one point he describes how in different stages of life one has a different outlook. He says a child is a realist because a child tries to figure out how things are. What are apples? What are bananas? What is? What's going on? That's a child's business. So a child is a realist. He said, but a youth is an idealist, right? And then he says, but in midlife, one becomes a cynic. Right? It's not really like, you know, what you thought it's going to be. He said, but in old age, or in mature age, he says, one begins to see that success or failure doesn't just depend on someone's qualifications. He said, sometimes an intelligent man is not at all successful, and a fool is successful. Therefore, he said, success is not depending on just the logic of the world. And he begins to see that beyond the world, there is another reality, transcending the world, and he becomes a mystic.
So this way, okay,
Goethe recognizes some sort of natural tendency in us. Oh. And I was reflecting on these words and then thinking, yes, in my childhood, my father took me then to a family grave, and it was a very shocking experience. Not so much because of the family grave, because actually the relative who had died wasn't very dear to me at all, so I didn't care so much about that. That's not why it was a shocking experience. The reason why it was a shocking experience, because I read on some of the tombstones that children who were younger than me had also died. That shocked me. Phew. So anyway, but I survived it, so it wasn't that bad. And then in my youth, indeed, I became an idealist, and I sang songs about compassion and freedom and other lofty goals, and then traveled towards the East in search for deeper meaning to life. In midlife, I was like terribly entangled in lots of responsibility, and indeed, I began to question, is this what I really wanted out of life? I questioned what I had become. And I lost my faith, as Goethe had predicted. And I guess by now I've sort of entered the mystical stage
of life, which is a good stage, actually.
That's why this is the best, actually, best part, the mystical part. Because that is true. Nothing is ordinary. Nothing. Everything has meaning. Everything is spiritual. Therefore, we are actually connected to everything. Modern society creates some sort of image of the objective observer, right? And we are trained to be objective. But objectivity is simply an illusion. There is no such thing as objectivity. It doesn't exist. One is always subjective. We are always subjected to so many external influences that have direct effect on us. And the other way around, we also have effect on our environment. Thus, everything is subjective. And no two people can be in the same room. We are not in the same room. Because
nobody, we're not seeing the same room. The room that I'm seeing has a clock on the wall. The room that you're seeing has a black figure with big
round eyes, isn't it? But you're all seeing it from a different angle. So we're not seeing the same room. We're all seeing from our own perspective. And actually, who are we? I am what I am, is a strong statement, which we hear from time to time, you know. But who are we? Because who are you when you are with your friends? Who are you at work? Each time a different personality comes out. So who are we? Are we an entity in itself? Or are we always in relationship with? And whatever we are in relationship with is different, you see. If we put, if we enter into a spooky castle at midnight, things are a little different. I have experimented with these things. And one time, I was trying to scare my girlfriend by telling ghost stories at midnight.
And I got really into it. I made it extremely dramatic, you know. Like, and
then, you know, just as it's really midnight, someone outside knocked with a fist on the door. I tell you, I got a heart attack. I was more shocked than she was. You know. Oh, God. Up to the day of today, but never know who knocked on the door. It was a real loud, pounding knock on the door. God, oh, God. What to say? So consciousness is always changing, and consciousness is influenced by the circumstances, sometimes by the immediate circumstances, or sometimes in a more long term, we fall in love with someone and it stays with us for some time and changes everything for a while, or the other way around. A relationship breaks and can take a long time to get over it and to see the world again in normal light. So all these things, so many things enter into our consciousness and have their effect. All these things that do enter into our consciousness are Krishna's energy. And when Krishna's energy enters into our consciousness, then when we remember the connection that it has with Krishna, then everything is fine. And then we can use it for the right purpose. But when we forget the connection that it has with Krishna, then we are becoming carried away by these impressions of his energy. So the essence is to always see the origin of everything, Krishna, and to see him in connection with everything. When we do that, then we come to the transcendental platform, the platform where we rise above the material world. So this, the mantra, has that very effect on our consciousness. It kind of lifts us. It lifts us up from being so entangled in so many feelings and emotions and thoughts and desires in relation to so many things. But when we see where they all come from, then, and we see Krishna behind it, then we can also gradually begin to understand his purpose with all these things, and that it ultimately is positive. One who sees with transcendental vision can see everything as a positive end, because he can see Krishna behind everything, and Krishna is all good. We have everything. Everything is positive. That is a very deep state of consciousness. In that deeper state of consciousness, one becomes internally very peaceful, very unaffected by so many external things. That is the essence. Any questions about that topic?
I was just thinking that, how is that, even if you make so much progress with your consciousness, that it seems that you can get swept away in a second, you know?
Even if you make so much progress in your consciousness, you can be swept away in a second. Yes, we can be swept away in a second. But then, we don't drown. It's like using the swept away metaphor is a metaphor of a river with waves, right, and a current that grabs us and takes us away. And for a while, then we are swept away by the waves and struggling on the waves. But then after some time, that river again throws us on a bank. And then that spiritual realization is not gone. It's not gone. Even if for a while, let's say through spiritual realization, we came to embrace higher values. Let's say values of compassion, values of purity. To not cause suffering to other living beings is a higher form of existence. To rise above lust, and to rise above seeing others as objects for our enjoyment, but to actually become a well-wisher of others, is a higher state of consciousness. To become austere and accept the conditions of life without constantly trying to fight is wise. And to have faith that there is a truth that is absolute and beyond all mundane things, that is a spiritual platform. So when the consciousness is elevated, one has realized these things, compassion, one has curbed lust, one has come to acceptance of hardships in life, and one is open and committed to the absolute truth. But then one is swept away. And when, as one is swept away, one may lose some of the values that had been achieved. But they don't just disappear. Nor does one's respect for them disappear. Even if one falls down from the platform, still one knows, this is what I really want to be. This is what I should be. There's nothing less I can be. And after some time, one will try again. Maybe
after having been swept away initially, one's lost self-confidence and faith, I can't do it. But after some time, it's still the only option. So, it's not that everything is lost when we get swept away. So being swept away and getting back on our feet is also part of the learning curve. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking that I'm thinking about meditation, and meditation is often depicted as a process to empty the mind. And there is an element of truth in that, because the mind becomes overburdened by so many unnecessary thoughts that we carry with us and just let go. But obviously, merely emptying the mind is not the approach. Fill the mind with positive experience. The idea is, here's Krishna. He's all-attractive, supreme being. We are always in relationship with him. And everything in this world has a purpose. And in fact, things don't have one purpose. Things have many purposes. You can do many things with the energy around us. But the highest purpose of things is the purpose of the Supreme. So when we begin to see what is the highest purpose of using anything, and we begin to consequently use everything for the highest purpose, then our consciousness gets lifted to the highest extent. And that is the ultimate aim of meditation. So it's something positive. It's not only emptying out the consciousness, but also filling it with acting for the highest purpose, connecting everything to the highest purpose. Everything. Because if meditation is only emptying the mind, then it's only like negation of the negative. You pick up certain stress and certain negative things, and then you make yourself free from the negative. That's not enough. Free from suffering. Okay, you're free from suffering. Congratulations. But what about filled with enjoyment? What about filled with happiness? What about when you're free from suffering, you're automatically filled with happiness? Well, not automatically. That is relief. That's not happiness. That's relief. There's a difference between relief and happiness. You know what I'm saying? It's like if I've been freezing in the cold and I'm cold to the bone, I'm certainly very happy to sit next to a warm heater, right, with a cup of warm tea. But actually, that's just, I got relief from the cold. But I need a positive experience to really speak of happiness. I need a positive, meaningful experience. So this is what we are searching. This is what we are looking for. Just so giving up the negative means we can turn away from the world. Therefore, sometimes it is felt that meditation is a process where we close ourselves off. We go like deep inside and withdraw from things. And so the more you are withdrawn, the more advanced you are. But that's not necessarily so. Meditation can also be active. Meditation can also be a way to work, a way to do anything. It's just that change the purpose, turn around the purpose of what we are doing, and work for spiritual principles, like I was saying, work for compassion, for the benefit of all living beings, work for cleanliness, purity, work to rise above love, lust, and instead act upon love. Lust means to exploit another living being for one's own enjoyment. Love means to try and give to someone else. And then become tolerant, not so easily disturbed. Become and make the truth the goal of life. Not only I'm trying to keep head above water. That's life. And I'm trying to have a good time at the same time. No, there's something more to life. The truth. So all these things are like setting our life on a spiritual course. And then we can make it, enrich it further. Yes. Then the positive is in place. So that can be done while we are everywhere, while we're out there, while we don't need to withdraw in a introspection is nice, but communication is also nice. To be with people is also nice. To have exchanges is also nice, if everything is positive. So our meditation is there so that we can enter into positive relationships. But positive relationships always include the Supreme. Then it becomes positive. So even between two people, there's that third element, the Supreme. Or even possessing anything, there's that third element, the Supreme. Whatever it is, 1 + 1 = 3. 1 + 1 must always be 3. If 1 + 1 = 2, it's not good enough. Always have to add that extra element of the Supreme. Then it's clear. Yes. How is this? How can this be used in service of Krishna? And then everything automatically becomes perfect. Very simple formula. So, the formula to make everything perfect, just add Krishna to anything. And then look at it from the Krishna perspective. Then immediately it gains meaning. But that's very difficult to do. But the chanting, which is our meditation, either softly on beats or singing, that is what gives us the strength to focus, the remembrance. Otherwise we forget. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. It's always hard to stop. Lovely stop. All the yogas are about stretching. But yoga. A little different, so. A little stretch may be a good idea. But there is obviously the mantra awakens our natural Krishna consciousness, and in that way our taste also for the chanting increases and increases and increases. So we'll do it again some other time. Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. For those of you who are not familiar, the next part of the program is Prasadam. We both make our way down to Kovid Vestirischa. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Ramakanda Swami Maharaj Ki.
In case you have a question about the analogy, because one of us, I have a question about the analogy.
Yes, sir.
And yesterday I did that melody, right?
Yes.
We're down to the restaurant.
Thank you.
Yeah, when the wolves came in, it started to go.